Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
And of course, that is Embryonic Journey. And that is by Jefferson Airplane, if, in case you didn't know. Can you hear me?
I'm sorry, are we on the air?
Yes, we are.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Hi, good, Russ. And it's another Thursday night. And this is, of course, LA Talk Radio. And this, you are listening to The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christina. I am your host in studio tonight with my fourth Thursday of every month host, Russ Avison.
Yeah, except I missed last month.
Yeah, you
month.
Did. Yeah. I'm sorry.
But I've recovered. I've recovered.
Yes, well, that's because you have a bad knee.
No, I was just on a bender. That was it.
No, yeah, I recognize that in you. you're just a guy. How you been? How's life? How's the ranch?
Everything's good. No complaints about anything.
Good.
Yeah, except my knee. But it's
good.
It's getting better.
Good.
So other than that, life is status quo. It's not changing much, which we're going to talk about.
We have a phenomenal show tonight. We do. And before we get started, of course, we have to run through the obligatory people who pay money to have us read their ads on the air. So I'm going to skip the Custany Bay ad tonight only because I don't have one, and Richard's not here to read his. So I'm going to go directly to Out West, which is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, fashion, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise. National brands include Rock Mount Ranchwear, Scully Leather Company, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. You can shop online at www.outwestshop.com or www.scvoutwest.com. Both of them will get you to different websites, but the same company. Enter code WB100. And you get $10 off your first order. And you can call them, of course, toll-free at 877-340-9378. That's Jim and Bobby Jean Bell.
In Albuquerque.
And they, of course, abandoned us, and so here we are. Okay, since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service, TFM truckload, and LTL service that is the best in the industry. Not only are they exceptionally good at what they do, but they work hard to make your full truckload shipping or LTL experience unparalleled using their customized traffic movement program. So call TFM Truckload or Target Freight Management LTL today at 844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski for truckload or any of the fine account managers at 888-653-1323 for LTL. Tell them you heard it on The Writer's Block, and TFM will have a little something extra for you. Or, if you prefer, you can go to www.targetfmi.com. And nice folks. No Mike. Well, he's really a great guy. Okay, I have an opening bio for our guest tonight. I'm going to put you on the air here, Sharon, because you need to be able to respond to this, because there will be a quiz at the end. Mm-hmm. Our guest tonight is Sharon Weil, and she's sitting over here wondering what's going to happen next, and I'm going to tell her. This is your bio. This is from research that we've been able to garner on you. Oh, you were an employee of the CIA for over 20 years.
You're not supposed to know that.
Carried on an affair with a Russian spy named Sergei Rastatsevich for approximately 6 years before being uncovered and forced to finally get dressed. Asked to leave Belgium for making Google Eyes at the Italian ambassador until his wife complained that you were attending all of their cocktail parties naked. Codenames, Sweet Cheeks, Smokin' Hot Mama, and The Vixen. Has 3 daughters from 5 different men, all agents of foreign governments, all owed money from Sharon for obvious services rendered. Finally sitting down and writing the book Changeability because...
She needed
well,
to change,
because
apparently.
Frankly, she needed desperately to change. Okay, that's all we could garner on you, Sharon.
Well, you're the least interesting guest we've ever had.
Okay,
wow,
now let's get
this stuff.
Let's get to the real one.
Amazing.
Sharon Weil has been engaged in the conversation about courage and change as an author, activist, award-winning filmmaker, and somatic educator. She is the author of Changeability: How Artists, Activists, and Awakeners Navigate Change. And it's from Archer Rare Bird Books in 2016, which draws upon the collective wisdom of 25 change innovators across many fields. Changeability Playbook. Here, how to navigate your own change. She brought actually samples of all of this stuff. Her quirky romantic...
Hold it up to the microphone.
Yeah, romantic mishap novel, Donnie and Ursula Save the World, is called the funniest book about love, sex, and GMO seeds you'll ever read. Passing 4 Normal Press 2013. She is also the host of Passing 4 Normal Podcast, iTunes, Conversations About Change, SharonWeilAuthor.com. So let's welcome to the Writer's Block, Miss Sharon Weil.
Thank you.
Well, we have to do that because they get antsy sitting over there by themselves.
Yeah.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm very
That's why
good.
I told you
Welcome.
You have to bring your sense of humor
Thank
tonight.
You.
Uh-huh. This changeability was quite a fascinating read. It kind of opens your eyes in a lot of different ways.
Yes. Well, it was certainly a change from most of the books that we... You know, read mm-hmm. for the show,
because, right?
But yeah, I mean, we get a lot, mostly novels,
right?
And this was eye opening. You're right; that was exactly what it was.
We try not to do a lot of self help books because it on the air it really doesn't
really
and no, no it really doesn't
people, most because our listeners help, don't
right.
need the help
well, because
they,
you know
help.
They can go to the library and there's a whole rack.
Yes,
mm-hmm. you know. And you notice that every time you go to the library, the same label is in the same spot because nobody ever gets it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this is not a self-help book. This is more about a self-improvement or change, you know, because as Russ brought up earlier, everybody has to change.
I would say self-awakening.
Yeah, self-awakening, self-awareness.
That's a nice way to put it. You know, really, I wrote this book in order to help people be able to navigate the changes in their lives with more flexibility and more ease and less resistance mm-hmm. because change is happening all the time, whether we want to admit it or not, whether we want to face it or not. We're constantly in the middle of something that's changing. This moment, next moment, it's always changing. And some people have an easier time of working with change than others. Some people are just flat out resistant, whether it's denial, whether it's procrastination, whether it's stubbornness, whether it's attachment to the way they want things to be or wish they could be. You know, people have challenges in how they meet change.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really, you know, wanted to write this book and then the playbook, which is a way to work with your own personal questions about change, just to help people get, first of all, like you say, an awakened perspective about the nature of change. You know, it is the nature of this life is that change is moving all the time. Right, and I like to look at change in terms of the movement of change and that how is the movement of change moving? Is mm-hmm. it flowing? Is it flowing freely?
Mm-hmm.
Is it stagnant? Like, you know, like you think about a body of water, is it flowing? Are there wild rapids in it? Is it just dried up and nothing's happening? And so how do people manage when change is moving so quickly and they get overwhelmed? A lot of people get overwhelmed or confused in the face of complex change. Or how do you get change moving when you feel like things are very stuck and stale, mm-hmm. right, on mm-hmm. both sides?
Well, it was interesting. You were in toward the beginning of the book, you were talking about how everything is changing whether you want it to or not. And it made me I wrote what... The way I perceive what you were trying to get across, what I said, it's like swimming. So you're moving through water, and maybe you're heading toward a specific goal, a point.
Mm-hmm.
But even as you're swimming, the whole body of water is shifting.
That's
so
right.
Even though you're heading one way, you may be pushed one way or the other. And that's why you see, like, sailboats. They mm-hmm. have to tack against the wind, because otherwise they're going to go the wrong direction. Everything is moving. And then you talked about the fluidity, which, again, I thought about the water.
Right. It's a constant navigation. It's kind of a moment-to-moment navigation. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, I identify seven principles that are common to all change situations or need to be present in all change situations. And one of them is about proceed incrementally, which mm-hmm. speaks to the timing of how you move, and that most people get overwhelmed by change because they think they have to bite off the whole enchilada. They have to do it all at once.
I am famous for doing that.
Right. So you make really large goals, and then you often feel disappointed.
And then you do nothing.
Or overwhelmed.
I'll look at this big thing. I've got to do this, 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 and this. And then I don't know which to do first, so I sit around and think more about what I should do, and then I don't do anything.
Right. And so when you break these larger tasks into smaller bite-sized pieces, well, just do this now, and tomorrow I'll do that, and the next day I'll do that, then it's more achievable. And so it's about breaking a larger thing into increments. Mm-hmm. And one of the helpful things about thinking about moving with change incrementally or approaching change incrementally are these course corrections along the way, like you're talking about. I'm a sailboat, and I'm sailing on the water, and I've got the wind, but every so often I've got to check in and see, am I on course? If I'm not, I make a course correction,
right.
And I go a little ways more, and then I get to check in again. Am I on course?
Mm-hmm.
No, I've gone to the left. Mm-hmm. Okay, course correction, perception, course correction, perception, course correction. It's the way we're constantly navigating.
I think that's what you said you got from your father, that he was really good at reading the market. He was in real estate, and how he would make, if something wasn't work right, he'd make small course corrections to get there.
That's right. And so, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. when businesses or people have large strategic plans, you know, it's important to have a plan. It's really important to know where you're going, mm-hmm. right? But it's also important that in that plan there's enough flexibility or enough pauses that you can read the market, read mm-hmm. the water, read the effectiveness mm-hmm. of what your plan is, and see, well, is this working? Do I need to go about it differently? Because some people will make the plan. This is the plan. It's the plan. You know, we all know these people, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're go on a trip with them or something. It's like, nope, this is the plan, and we got to stick with the plan.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Even if it's raining or if you're on the,
right.
nope, this is the plan. And so it's not helpful to be stubborn in that way or to be so focused. So it's a constant play between having focus, right, because we need focus, but also having enough flexibility
mm-hmm.
and sensitivity and the ability to listen,
mm-hmm.
which is another one of the principles that I talk about, listening deeply
mm-hmm.
to be able to listen to hear, well, is this working?
Mm-hmm.
Am I being effective?
Mm-hmm.
Am I happy? Do I like it? Right?
If not, change it.
If not, change it.
Right.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I used to tell my employees that, because they used to come in and say, well, I can't get this done. I say, why can't you get it done? Well, I have to do this, 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 this. I say, no. What you do is you take everything and you put it into a stack on your desk. And you start at the top, and you finish that, and you go on to the next thing.
Uh-huh.
That's the only way you're going to ever get done what you're doing. Because otherwise,
right.
you're going to be sitting here 2 weeks from now telling me the same thing. And nothing is going to be done.
Incrementally.
That's right.
Incrementally.
Yeah, and whatever way that is for you to divide the task up, you know, it can be sequential. It doesn't have to be sequential.
Sure.
It can be hopping around or whatever it is that works for your own style. But to understand that really all change, all goals are achieved incrementally.
Sure. But you have to actually, you have to actually want to have the change in your own person. I mean, there are some people that really, they don't want to change. I mean, they're happy the way they are.
Yes.
But they're still changing anyway.
But they're changing anyway.
Yes.
But then their brain's telling them, wait a minute, wait a minute, I don't want to do this, and right. it's too late, or they're on a downward spiral anyway.
Yes.
They're going to change regardless.
Yes.
We were talking earlier about the things are going so fast now, they're changing so fast in our world, in our country specifically, mm-hmm. that we don't have time to sit and think about change.
Yeah.
It's happening whether we want it to happen or not.
Right, and I talk about complex change, mm-hmm. that it's not just one thing, you
right.
know, and especially when people experience, you know, significant change in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody dear to them dies, or you lose your job, or you have to make a move. You know, these are big changes that often have many other changes that are cascading off of that change, right?
Sure.
And so it's complex change. And it seems like because of technology, because of speed of communication, because of, I don't know, some people are saying that time literally is moving faster, that we don't even have time to catch our breath.
Right.
Between, you know, we'll keep going back to the water metaphor, between this wave and the next wave,
right.
and the next wave of change.
Right.
And it can... really impair people's ability to just think clearly, see clearly, sort it out, right? Because we are responding to not only, like I say, these cascading changes, this complex change, but also, like we're saying, it's just fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going so fast.
So do you think that it's bringing up a good point. It just screams in your brain. Like the younger children, not the children, but the young adults,
mm-hmm.
the 13 to 18 or 13 to 20,
yes.
when they've got so much going on at one time and they're changing every
yes.
day.
Yes.
Their bodies are changing, their hormone levels are changing. Everything is just like confusing. It's crazy to
yeah.
them. And they're emotionally, they go through, I don't know how many changes they go through a day. But, I mean... Is there ever a point when that comes to a screeching halt to them and they finally can sit back and say, okay, I've done that. Now, where do I go from here?
Yeah, right.
You know,
I think that different phases of life, there are different sort of change questions that come up at different different times
mm-hmm.
of life. I
mm-hmm.
think that, you know, what you're describing now is the, okay, now what do I want to do with my life?
Right.
Now that I feel like I have to really plan a course, you know,
right.
what's that? What is that going to be? That's
right.
kind of in your 20s and 30s.
Yeah,
right?
mid-20s. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, as a young adult, you don't have time to think about that because there is so much else going on with you.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember being 16.
Yes.
17. Mm-hmm. That's a long time ago.
Okay, but you can still remember.
I can still remember that.
Yeah.
But it was confusing to me, and I had a lot going on with my life. I mean, I was a very busy guy in school, and I just had a lot mm-hmm. of stuff going on. But I always remember being somewhat jumbled,
uh-huh.
I guess would be a good word for it. Because I couldn't pinpoint anything. It would be there, and you'd go to grab it. It's gone. It's changed now. It's over here, and it's something totally different.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow.
And so, what was your response to that?
Well, it's either you move over there,
yes,
or go nuts trying to still find it here.
Right.
You
and,
know.
Right. And
so
that's what
you've
I'm
changed.
Talking about.
Yeah. Right.
Is the need to build in.
Right.
Of flexibility. It's like a training. It's like literally a training to train yourself to have more a range of flexibility to meet what comes. You know, it literally is a training that you can do with your body. You know,
uh-huh.
I talk in my bio, I talk about that I'm a somatic educator. I teach a kind of a movement work called continuum, which is a fluid-based movement work, and it really is using the body as our primary resource. And
mm-hmm.
so with your breath, with your body, you can train yourself to accommodate abrupt, rapid, even shocking change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people, it's like some people digest change better. If you breathe well,
yes,
if you
that's
breathe
absolutely
well,
true.
You can accommodate rapid change better
right.
than if
how
you don't
many
breathe
times,
at all.
I was going to say, how many times have things been going a little wonky and you got all these things going at work or whatever it is, and you're like, and somebody say, just take a breath.
Right.
And that's really what
yes.
it is. It's just to kind of get control of your body.
Right.
That's
and,
right.
Okay, now I can think squarely after.
What's that phrase that you used to have bumper stickers? The faster I go, the behinder I get.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think,
and taking a breath means taking an in-breath, having the pause, and the out-breath.
Right.
All of it.
The cleansing.
Yeah. All of it to just, you know, kind of reset, right?
Well, you know, there was, and I don't recall which one of your guests, we'll talk about how the guests are involved in the book.
Yes.
But one of them was talking about social media, and they thought it was really a bad thing.
Yes.
Which my acronym for it is C.
Uh-huh.
What do I call it now? Oh, CWT,
uh-huh.
which is colossal waste of time.
Oh, I absolutely agree.
It is a colossal waste of time, but the guest that you're referring to is Claire Hope Cummings,
correct.
Who is an environmental lawyer, activist, journalist, has been very involved in social causes, environmental causes for all of her adult life. And, you know, what she was saying about social media was that it actually gives us the illusion that we're taking an action.
Right.
You know, I'll click this.
Right,
I'll
you get
click
the email
that
says save the Bears. You know, click here and tell the president
I
saved
the Bears.
To save the Bears.
I saved the Bears.
Yeah. And you
I
did
click,
nothing. You did
right.
nothing.
And so it gives the illusion, you know, on the one hand, it is good for calling people together, letting people know there's going to be a march on March 24th, you know, in
right.
Washington against assault weapons. And
right.
It's a good way to let people know things and to gather, but to actually, it actually replaces a lot of things, right? It replaces real action. It can replace interaction,
mm-hmm.
real interaction.
Yeah,
you
sure.
know, people have, well, I got a lot of friends on social media, but who do you go out to coffee with or who's bringing you soup when you're sick?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody.
Yeah. And in actuality, they aren't your friends because you don't really know them.
That's true.
Yes.
That's true. But also, we were talking about you take that pause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at night when I put the phone aside, I'm done.
Yeah.
And there's days when I just I'll leave it on my desk in the office. I just don't want to deal with it. I want to enjoy life for what it is, and it's not this electronic gadget in my face all the time, which has changed the way we all function.
It completely changes
right.
the way we function. I mean, we didn't used to have this gesture, and people can't see, but I'm bending over, looking at my palm. This gesture didn't exist in our world
right.
until
or the two thumbs.
Recently. Yeah. Or when you say, I'm going to call you, you know, we used to like put our hand up
right.
like this, and
yeah.
now I call you
yeah.
with my thumbs. I make a little gesture
uh-huh.
with my thumbs, I'm going to call you, which means I'm going to text you, I'm not going to call you.
Right, right.
But it's the same idea, but to be able to have the freedom to literally unplug from these devices and this way in which we are in constant barragement of information
mm-hmm.
or, you know, and not, again, not able to discern between important information and not important information. It all comes in the same
Well,
portal,
yeah,
right?
It's coming at you 900
yeah.
miles an hour
right.
and you don't have time to process.
Do you remember,
right.
There was a commercial probably about a year ago, I think it was for AT&T, and it showed the home where the internet goes down.
Uh-huh.
And they would say, like, 5 minutes after the internet went down,
yes.
and the people are kind of trying to looking at their phones.
Yes,
and nothing's
yes. Yeah.
Then they go 2 hours after, and the wife's sitting on the floor in the kitchen, and she's got her phone, and she's banging her finger on the screen. Boom, boom. How are they going to know I like this? Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is the most absurd life we have.
That's
it's
it.
Crazy.
It
I
is
know.
Is insane. Hey, let me give a phone number here. In case you want to call and talk to Sharon tonight, our number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. And you can actually call and talk to the real life Sharon Wiles.
Oh, my
she's
God.
Sitting right here looking
the
at
Russian
me.
Spy, yes.
The Russian spy, well, the CIA spy.
And she's naked.
Yeah. Sweet cheeks.
So, you know, getting back to the book a little bit, and I alluded to the fact that you had guests in the book,
yeah.
which is,
yes.
that's an unusual thing to say,
uh-huh.
is that you had several guests in the book.
Uh-huh.
But can you tell us a little bit about how you put this together? Because, I mean, well, you just go ahead and explain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I began a podcast called Passing for Normal: Conversations with Artists, Activists, and Awakeners about Seeding Change in the World, because I wanted to speak to real people, artists, activists, and awakeners, who were what I considered to be working very interestingly with change across many different fields. I mean, I spoke with people who are involved, obviously, like therapists and psychologists and people in the somatic field, but also prison reform and a lot of people in permaculture and sustainable farming and spirituality and writers and potters and a magician who goes to refugee camps all over the world. He and his wife bring magic to refugee camps as a way of bringing hope. And so I was asking them about, you know, how do you work with change and what's important about change and how is it that you are brave in the face of change, whether it's personal change or whether it's social change. You know, Claire Hope Cummings, who I mentioned, how, you know, she wrote the first definitive book about genetically modified seeds. You know, how do you stand up against Monsanto? How do you stand up against the corporation? I ask guests, how do you stick with a hopeless cause, like a seemingly hopeless cause? Something like, you know, mainstream medicine someone's working in, or prison reform, or, you know, all these things. And their answers were so well considered and so informative to me. I felt like I was going to school, you know, talking to these people, and I started to hear common things that they were saying about how they approached change. Now, granted, I was selecting these people because they represented sort of a field of thinking or a way of thinking that I gravitated towards, but still, they were saying these things to me that were common. And so then, and so then I started to check them out with them. You know, what do you think about these seven principles that I was starting to arrive at that were common to change? And so I decided to write this book, Changeability, called Changeability, because I want people to be able to build the ability to change. And so in the book, it's a weaving of my narrative thread with 25 different voices of these amazing change makers, including excerpts from their podcasts, as well as talking about the work that they're doing to illustrate what we are all talking about in terms of how to approach being able to make change with more flexibility.
It was interesting too. I noticed that the whole book has kind of an environmental activist leaning.
Yes, it does.
I loved it.
Yes,
I put this name down here, and I'm not, when I wrote my note here, Penny Livingston Stark.
Yes,
Okay, and she was talking about our connection to the earth.
Yes.
And there was, she said something that seriously almost brought a tear to my eyes. She says, our earth is sick.
Yeah.
And we've got to help it. And, you know, you live here in Los Angeles, and you know that probably here, maybe New York might be the same. See, we are so self-centered. And, you know, she was talking about the fact that we can, we have the resources that we don't need to be mining for any more goods. We don't have to be, putting holes in the earth. We don't have to continually pollute. We have everything we need to, we can have a sustainable life here, and we're not doing it.
Not only that, but she was also saying that we actually have the solutions to the climate problems already in play, but in small places, right? We actually know some of these answers. We actually have some of this technology to sequester carbon from the atmosphere, or to purify water, or to remediate the soil that has been polluted. We actually have some innovative technologies, but people don't know about them, or they're not being funded, or they're not being paid attention to. So she was saying both things. She was saying that we have enough, but she was also saying that the solutions already exist.
Or people are being paid not to use them.
Or people are being paid not to use them, and that's a whole other
right
thing. You know, the book has a very environmental leaning because when I started interviewing guests, it was based on some of the subjects in the novel that I had written previously, Donnie and Ursula Save the World, which you said was called the funniest book about love, sex, and genetically modified seeds. It's this romantic comedy about these mismatched lovers who, through the power of their eros, become reluctant activists and take on a plot by an agribusiness giant to own all the seeds of the world. And so it's a funny book, it's a sexy book, but it's a serious book, and it's actually kind of a primer about GMOs. And so because the book was about seeds, because it was about, permaculture, because it was about eros, I started talking to people who were related to those areas, and so that's one of the reasons why there's so much of that conversation mm-hmm. in this book. Plus, mm-hmm. it's a subject that's very important to me.
I need to break for just a minute, Russ, and actually we need to do your commercial.
Oh, okay. Well, take your break then.
And
Sharon and I will continue chatting here on the side.
You can continue chatting.
How do the teachers say chat among yourselves?
Okay, yeah.
I just turned you off. There you go. Okay, here we go. You're leaving on vacation. Tickets have been purchased. Hotel reservations are confirmed. Mail delivery has been suspended. And, what about the dog? All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepovers. It's the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside amongst the orange trees and grass in a serene country setting. Yes. I turned you off, Rush. You can't say anything. Oh, here, I'll turn you back on. There we go. Your dog gets to be a dog. All Dogs Rule offer additional services, including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming sessions in the creek, and training. Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. When your pup returns home, that smile on his face will leave you wondering whose vacation was better. Well, we know the answer, the dogs.
That's right.
Yeah. And we have, of course, the owner of All Dogs Rule sitting across from me right now. Anything you want to add there, Mr. Everson?
No, you did such an exquisite job.
I do.
Except something happened with you. All of a sudden got very distorted.
I got very loud all of a sudden.
When you shut mine off, yours got really loud.
Yeah. I don't know what happened there. Anyway, that's it. It is now 7:30 on the nose. We're in the studio tonight with Sharon Weil. And she and Russ have been having a private conversation over here in the corner. I hate it when they do that because my name usually comes up.
If you
want to call in and talk to Sharon, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. And you can call and talk to Sharon Weil live in person. I always like that, you know, on TV shows. And I say, filmed in front of a live audience.
Yeah.
It's opposed to what? A dead audience?
That's right.
Canned audience. There you go.
Hey, getting back to something we were talking about, I mean, obviously the book is all about being able to make change.
Right. Yes.
And you talk about that not all change is good. Some is detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a quote, and I'm sorry, I didn't write down who had the quote, but it says that when you have detrimental change, what you want to be able to do is throw sticks into the spokes of the detrimental change to halt it.
Yes.
And can you elaborate a little bit more on that type
was,
of change?
That was Michael Stalker, who's an environmental activist on behalf of the oceans. And, what he's saying is that, you know, certain changes you want to try to slow down. You know, that they're change. You know, sometimes the approach to change is to help facilitate change, and sometimes what you want to do is literally, you know, slow it down. You know, throw sticks in the spokes so that it can't.
It was a great analogy, though.
It really truly is. Yeah.
It is a great analogy, but it's the whole idea of resistance, right? You know, on the one hand, we think of, oh my goodness, I have a lot of resistance to change. On the other hand, sometimes resistance is necessary. You know, we're seeing politically the whole resistance movement mm-hmm. to certain, you know, government policies. And sometimes the first thing that you do is that you try to put a drag on the movement of change just to slow it down if it's going too fast. I mean, biologically, the purpose of resistance is to slow down something that's moving too fast, too much too soon, right? So, you know, the cell puts up a resistance. Sometimes resistance defines what's on the outside from what's on the inside, like the cell wall defines that, right? Or, you know, like when you're landing, the landing gear is, in an airplane, the landing gear is putting a resistance on your speed so that you are slowing down. So sometimes it's necessary to slow down, and you want to, whether you're slowing yourself down or you're trying to slow down, you know, some other movement of change. The question is then what happens? You know, once we've sabotaged the wheel, once we've slowed down, once we've resisted, then what? And quite honestly, I'm interested in the then what. You know, then what's the next solution? What's the next idea? What's the next hopeful thing that we can work towards?
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Kind of switching gears a little bit, where did this whole idea that you decided to write a book about change, where did that from where did that come?
Well, it actually came from my publisher, but
that was easy enough.
Wow. Okay, on to the next subject.
Okay. Here, write this book, please.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, he said this podcast is really interesting. You should write a book from it.
Okay.
And so the suggestion came from publisher Tyson Cornell at Rare Bird Books, and but then, of course, you know, really deciding what it was that I wanted to say about change and how I wanted to work with these voices and how I wanted to bring them forward and what it was that they were illustrating was my own machinations. I had mentioned to you earlier that I've been a filmmaker, I've been a writer, director, editor, and that writing this book in this particular way that I did, and I wrote it very quickly, I had to, because it was like this whole complex tapestry of a world that I literally couldn't let go of.
Sure.
If I let go of it, it would just ravel apart. You know, as a writer, a lot of times you get into a world that you're writing in, and sometimes it lets you leave and come back and leave and come back. Sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
Sometimes it says you are here for the duration, and everything else in your life has to take a back seat.
Right.
Well, in this case, I have to say that I wrote 8 to 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, all summer long, the summer that I wrote it, because if I didn't, I would have lost the threads. But doing it was like editing a documentary movie, meaning that, you know, when you do a documentary, it's often not scripted. They hand you a bunch of footage, and you have to find the story. I mean, hopefully there was a story in mind that was being filmed, but you have to make the story from what you have. So I was making the story from the material that I had from these interviews. And so the ideas that I had about how to connect this social activist, what they're saying, with this person who's speaking about, you know, changing your breath to change your life, or this person's talking about shamanism, or this person's talking about prison reform. How am I going to weave all of those voices together and what they're saying? And so it was really a complex puzzle that I enjoyed. I enjoyed the complex challenge of it.
Well, what happened, I think, by putting these 25 voices in here, you change not the narrative, but the text, the fiber of the book, because instead of one voice giving you all this information, there are different voices, and even though you can't hear them, the perspectives are all different, and so it keeps it very interesting. Because you start thinking, well, this isn't just this one person's opinion. This is here. This person said this. This person said this. And you kind of, when I finished the book, I felt that it all came together. It all had kind of a global feeling to it. So yeah, I think it worked very well.
Great. Yes. And sometimes, you know, these voices were meant to be counterpoint. You know, or just counterpoint a perspective like large social change, personal change, or you know, they were meant to be counterpoint, and sometimes they were really saying the same thing. This one's saying it this way, that one's saying it this way. And, you know, wanting to really stress for the reader that these principles that we're talking about are universal. These seven principles are universal. Or when we look at what the nature of change is, how it moves, it's universal, and it applies to all your external changes. It applies to your internal changes. You can apply it across the board, which was, I have to say, much to my delight, a great discovery. Once I discovered these seven principles, I said, okay, does it work over here? Does it work over here? Does it work over here? And when I saw that it was, I was very happy.
That would be those?
Yes, that would be those right there.
I actually put them in bold.
Uh-huh.
Large so letters, bold.
Yeah.
So I can read them.
So those of us with changing eyesight can read them. Yeah. So,
yet another reason to change.
So you had the heading of one of your, not a chapter, but a section of the book, that you said, change facilitates healing.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering how this equates to what's going on in Washington right now. Any thoughts?
Yeah.
Any that you could actually express on the air?
You know, my politics are extremely liberal, mm-hmm. and I don't hide it.
Good, you're preaching to the choir there. So
uh-huh. Yeah. The entire room is is with you.
And you know, because I believe in equality, because I believe in fairness, because I believe in hope and not meanness, and so there is an incredible amount of healing that needs to take place. And our leaders are not facilitating anything towards healing, towards reconciliation, towards even inclusiveness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that what you're talking about comes from the chapter that talks about that lasting change, that healing promotes lasting change, in that, you know, sometimes when someone has resistance to changing, it's because they've had trauma, whether it's physical trauma, emotional trauma, sexual trauma, something has traumatized them. And so there is something deeper that has to be restored. You know, one of the ways that I talk about healing is that it restores wholeness.
So would you say then that our current president has basically traumatized this country, and now we have to draw healing from this?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, not only the president, but those who will not put people first, mm-hmm. you know, or putting money first, or putting, you know, business first.
But even if you take that concept, and I mean, yes, we like to make fun of the president, we all do, but if we look at Washington, even when, and I respect Obama, mm-hmm. and we've had over the, you know, the last 20 years, we had the Republicans, we had the Democrats, but really, Washington is broken. It's
yes.
It's not just the president
yes.
right now. And so, but do you think that this particular event in our history, having this particular president come in and just stir everything up, and whether you support him or not, do you think this is the change now that maybe can promote healing?
I think that it's possible. You know, it certainly has brought more awareness.
Yes.
You know, people have had to step out of complacency.
Right.
You know, when Obama was president, you know, some people didn't like him being president at all. Mm-hmm. But those of us who did like him being president
right.
felt like, okay, you know, it's getting taken
we
care of.
We have Henry calling in. Go ahead and finish. I'm just going to tell him to hang tough.
And so it has certainly brought
hang tough just a minute, Henry.
It's brought up awareness, sure, and it's brought up the need for people to take action. You know, look how many people are stepping up into marches, into, you know, into taking action, into speaking out. And, you know, we must find dialogue. We must, you know, the country is very split. It has been for many, many years. We must find, and it's becoming more and more polarized.
Absolutely.
You know, where people don't even want to talk to people who think outside of their way of thinking.
Right, and their belief systems, right.
And they don't even have, they're getting less and less access to information beyond their belief system because we have two news services, basically, you know, in this country. And so, so a dialogue is necessary. And do I think that, I mean, it feels pretty dire, right? But oftentimes it is, it's when it is most urgent that we finally will take an action or we will finally break open our hearts. I mean, if this shooting that took place at the high school in Florida doesn't break our hearts open to actually take a new action, what is it going to take?
Well, it's taking the kids to do it, and I think they're going to do it. They've now taken the bull by the balls, and they're just saying, no more. We're done.
That's right. And that was my question in Donnie and Ursula. When is enough enough? At what is that moment when someone steps up and says, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
We can't do this anymore.
Right, right.
Well, and I think also we have so many of these young people who are all going to be voters, if they're not already. They're going to be voters within the next few years. And they said to their representatives, they said, look, if you don't make changes, we're going to be changing it.
Well, yeah, we're changing you.
We're going to change it, yes. You know, one of the guests in the book, Paul Loeb, has the Campus Election Engagement Project where all over the country they are registering students, educating students. This is a nonpartisan project, but college campuses getting students involved and saying, okay, vote. Mm-hmm. You want to make this change, vote.
Well, we have on the line with us right now Henry Park, and Henry is, of course, from Henry's Western Roundup and Blogspot. Hi, Henry.
Hi there. How's it going?
We're doing good. You want to say hello to Sharon Weil?
Yes, indeed. Hi, Sharon. I've been
Hi, Henry.
Oh, are you getting a reverb on me there?
No.
No, okay. I guess it's just on my end. Sorry. Hello, Sharon.
Hi, Henry.
It's just on your end, Henry. You reverb yourself.
I'm afraid I do, but I've been enjoying the conversation, and I just got to say, I think the kids in Florida are inspiring.
Oh, I'm absolutely.
Thrilled that they are, as you say, they're not waiting for everyone else to take care of the problem.
No, they're not.
Or they're moving for themselves.
It's, or not take care of the problem.
It's taken something like this to polarize our youth into making the changes that need to be made, and because we as adults are not willing to do it. And I think, you know, that's what happens. Anyway, Henry, you brought something to my attention the other day, and I shared it with Russ, and I spoke briefly with Sharon about it, and I wanted to spend the rest of the hour. We're going to be on until 8 o'clock tonight, and we're going to discuss this particular little thing that you brought up, and would you like to open the conversation on it?
Great. Well, what it is that we shared was an article by Everdeen Mason for the Washington Post. It's called Publishers Are Hiring Sensitivity Readers to Flag Potentially Offensive Comment. And it is about, well, now as writers, we all hand manuscripts to friends to ask if something works.
Absolutely.
And we go to people who know more about a subject or world than we do. I used to be very insecure about writing female characters, especially like two women talking in a scene with no men.
Uh-huh.
So I'd give it to my wife to read. And when my daughter was in high school and I was writing high school characters, I'd give it to her to read. And then, of course, completely rewrite it. Because she told me how far off
because
I was.
Because we don't understand the women.
We
absolutely
have no clue what they're about.
Right.
We're so mysterious.
You know, I get that. Yeah. And I get that, especially if you're writing for kids, you need to be very careful about what is acceptable.
Uh-huh.
But it seems to me from the article that these so-called experts are dictating what you can and cannot say about ethnic groups, transgender people, nationalities. It really seems like establishing official rules for the few snowflakes that every group contains that everyone is so terrified of offending. And to me, this kind of prior censorship is very un-American.
Oh, I totally agree with you.
Well, I think the problem is not where it's at right now, but it's that slippery slope. I was reading in that article that Everdeen Mason wrote. There was an author named Kate Messner, I'm sorry, and she's the author of many children's books. And she said that she wouldn't dream of sending out any of her books into the world without the help of these readers. to make sure that she gets it right. Now, her books sometimes deal with poverty and abuse and race, and so she wants to have the right angle on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's not any different than going to your publisher or going to your wife or someone else to help you. But it could set a precedence that, okay, if we're doing it now, what's the next step?
Right.
And I think that's the scary part.
Right. I don't think that writers, especially writers of more fiction than I think nonfiction, need to be told you have to be PC in the way you present people and certain things that are going on in your novel. And I think it's because you take away the essence of the story. And so if you're getting somebody who's a sensitivity reader and they're saying, wait a minute, I don't think you should call that black guy this. I think you should call him a black guy or whatever.
Right.
I mean, when we're talking about Mississippi in 1920, and they just didn't call black guys. They called them another word.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the vernacular of the day. And if you're writing a story about 1920 Mississippi, that's, you know, being
that's
politically correct is not right for the time period.
I know. Yeah. It's a very tricky thing, though,
right,
because language really does shape how we think.
Absolutely.
Right?
And if I may say, our language changes.
It's right.
It
does. Our language changes, but it reflects how we think and it shapes how we think both. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, we do want to be accurate in portraying a history, in portraying a certain group. But on the other hand, can we evolve our language so that it's not offensive and we're not constantly, you know, I'm Jewish and so, you know, there are terms that you know, were Jews were called or are called, and I don't appreciate it when people bring them up, even if they're bringing them up in a historical context, right? It's like writers can be really creative. They don't have to use the word that triggers people. They could find other ways to say things that could convey the same thing.
But if you're writing something historical,
yes,
and someone is speaking in that time frame,
yes,
and those are the words they would be using, why would you change it from what that person would actually say?
Especially if you don't, this character doesn't have to be necessarily sympathetic.
Right. That's a good point, Henry.
Huckleberry Finn was denounced when it was published. Now people are all upset, oh, it uses the N-word. But, I mean, when it was published, people were offended because it depicted the friendship of a white boy and a black man.
Right.
I mean, that would never have been published if we had sensitivity readers back then.
Right.
Right. It's always, you know, it's always dependent on the time. You know, the time is the context, and we're always living in a context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'm just curious, because I didn't have a chance to read this article, but I'm certainly willing to express my opinion.
Sure.
About it,
even sure. Well, and you're more
I
than welcome
about you.
Thank you very much. But, you know, don't editors and publishers look at things anyway? You know, a publisher may say, I can't publish this. We can't sell this. Or, you know, I mean, it's not that publishers or editors have ever changed your language.
Mm-hmm.
They do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that there hasn't been a person in a position to be specifically looking for that.
Right.
Well, being that
right.
I mean, you're all three of you are authors. I'm not. But I think if you want to be true to your craft and true to your artistic abilities of writing, that you don't want anybody coming in and say, well, you should change this word because I don't like it. Publishers are doing that to you, but sometimes it's because of the saleability of the book.
Well, that's their point of view.
Yes, and that's it. I can't sell it this way, but if we make these changes, I think we have a shot at selling it.
Yeah.
So now what do you want to do? Do you want to make the change, or do you want to stick to your guns and go find another publisher?
Well it's like peppering a book with the F word and the N word. You're not going to sell big in the Christian market.
No.
You know?
Right.
But if it's a book about the Civil War.
Yeah.
It's not going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to be a commercial artist of any sort, it's always a play between you know, what's going to sell, what do you want to say, and what's going to sell, right? You're always having to somehow shape it to the marketplace if you want to sell.
Sure.
Except for those rare breakthrough things that are just pure genius or pure expression, and they happen to catch fire, right?
Uh-huh.
And so, I don't know. I don't know why we have to keep offending people. Even if it's for the sake of history, you know, yes, that's what, that's how people were referred to in history. But what's wrong with evolving out of that now?
Well, I think that once you, when you're writing a bit of fiction, you're not writing to offend anyone. You're writing to tell a story.
Right.
I don't think any writer of fiction purposely goes out to tell a story to offend any group of people. You did?
I did.
No, you're talking about eros and orgasms and all kinds of stuff. But, I mean, in reality, no writer, I mean, myself included, goes out to purposely offend anyone. You know, I don't like certain words, but there are certain characters in my books that would use those words.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it's not just words. It's
attitudes. It's attitudes and, right, scenarios.
You know, I'm gonna bring up something that it has to do with what I do for a living, dog training, and but I'm kind of faced with a similar situation between what's saleable and what do I really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I have a path that I ask my students to take through a series of different classes to come out the other side with a really well-trained dog.
Mm-hmm.
And two of the classes, one's called Clicker Fun and one's called Intermediate. There were two separate classes, and I would always recommend do the Clicker Fun class, which will help you get into the Intermediate class. It'll be much easier for you. And I had a fair amount of success with it, but it wasn't overwhelming. So I tried one time, and I combined the Clicker and the Intermediate class into one class,
mm-hmm.
taking the best parts of both. And I sell out the classes. I still, to this day, I do not believe that's the best course of action for those students.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the ones they want to buy.
Right.
So now I have a choice. Do I continue with them training, or do I weed them out because I want to do it the way I want to do it?
Right.
Right.
And so I've elected. I'm doing the combination class. Hopefully I can still get some more effect with those dogs. But I had to do that because that's what the people wanted, not what I thought was going to be the best way to go. So well,
it's a lot of similarities there. What do you think, Henry? Yeah. I mean, you're sitting there being very quiet.
Which is unusual.
It always scares me when you are.
Sorry. It's always a trade-off. And as you say, I never set out to randomly offend people.
No.
But I certainly know that there are people that are essentially looking for things to be offended by.
I think you may have a point there, too.
I do not cater to them. You know, I was hearing a very mind-numbing conversation recently where people were talking about the upcoming Oscars, and they're saying that, well, they shouldn't give Sam Rockwell an Oscar for his performance in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Now, I thought his was a terrific performance among several others, but what I couldn't believe was they thought he shouldn't receive an Oscar for it because he plays a racist.
Right.
Well, that makes absolutely no sense.
Not to me, but to people who are so offended, so easily offended by, you know, story elements that they would blame an actor for what his character does. You know, I find it troublesome.
Right. Well, once again, that's a story about a particular time in a particular state that happens to be
right.
A little on the right side.
Well, and it's you know, and again, it's about the context because it's clear that movie was a very rough movie, but for a purpose.
Right.
You know, we didn't think that this was the right way to act.
Correct.
We weren't being told this is the right way to act. You know, so many people in that movie were so violent, such personal violence. But it, just like you were asking me, you know, can something that offends us actually awaken us to want to make a change?
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it's probably a good thing.
Has anybody ever read Raymond Chandler's, what was the title? Murder My Sweet, Farewell My Lovely is the novel, I think.
Got 100 years ago.
Because I remember how shocked I was by the opening, which is where there's a discovery of a murder in like right outside of a bar, and the police come to investigate, and they see the body there, and they say, "Oh, that's just a shine killing," and walk away, mm-hmm. like they're not even handling it. And I had to like look that up. What does that mean? And I found that that was an old slang for black people referring to shoe shines.
Really?
Oh.
And based on that, yeah, they weren't going to investigate the crime. And I mean, that's something I probably read when I was 15. And I was so offended but fascinated by, you know, realizing how different, you know, the police in that place at that time were looking at things versus today. I mean, you know, sometimes there's value to being offended. Because it really makes you examine things.
Right.
Have you noticed over time, though, how that line shifts? Like, we had the, I guess it was also in Florida, where the Nazis, the neo-Nazis were down there, and they had where the car ran down the street and ran over some people.
Yeah.
Charlotte, no,
okay.
Charlotte.
So, right, in Charlotte.
Charlottesville,
and,
yeah.
And Charlotte. So we have this situation come up, and everybody's saying, well, these neo-Nazis do not have a right to protest, even if it's peaceful. Mm-hmm. They should not be allowed to be out there because it's so offensive. And that line, where we draw the line, as far as, like, if a bunch of vegetarians came out and says, we're going to protest against meat eaters, mm-hmm. because we shouldn't be killing animals, mm-hmm. It's the same thing. That line drifts back and forth through time, mm-hmm. and it seems it's gone way that other side.
Yeah,
now.
We got to wrap this up.
We're
out of time.
Yeah.
Sharon, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been just a delight.
It's wonderful having you. And, yeah. and your book, of course, Sharon's book is Changeability. We have also here the workbook. It's actually called the Playbook. And she has flashcards. So
it's perfect for me.
Something for everyone.
Yeah.
It's the lightning round.
She does a little of everything, and we're just delighted that she was able to come in and join us tonight, because it was a lovely conversation.
Thank you.
It was good.
So much.
It was good. And thank you so much for joining us. And your email address is, and whatever.
Best way to reach me is SharonWeilAuthor.com. So SharonWeil author.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Russ, always a pleasure.
It is indeed. Thank
Henry,
you.
Henry, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll see you in April for sure.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
At the Santa Clarita Cowboy Fest.
That's it. That's it. April 20th and 21st, I believe it is. Okay.
That sounds right to me.
That's it. Next week we have Bianca Murray. She's the one that grew up in apartheid South Africa, and she's written a book called Hum, If You Don't Know the Words. It's a work of fiction, although it is based on her life. And everybody has been wondering what date John Sanford will be with us. That will be April 16th, I believe. He will be on the show with us. So if you are a Lucas Davenport fan, you don't want to miss that. And with that being said, it is another Thursday night come to a close. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us at the Writer's Block. Russ, thanks for being here.
Thank you, sir.
Sharon, thanks for joining us. Henry,
so
always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And we are going to be out of here in about 22 seconds. No, actually about 2 seconds. So here we go. We are gone. Well, maybe not yet. Now we are.
Happy trails.